This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Well, he went down to dinner in his Sunday best. Excitable boy, they all said. And he popped the pot roast all over his chest. Excitable boy, they all said.
Hi, folks. Bob Main here. Welcome to another episode of the Handgun World Show. The reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Thanks for tuning in, and this is a practical show. I'm not ex-law enforcement, I'm not ex-military, I'm not a gunsmith, and I'm not a firearms trainer, just an ordinary guy that likes to shoot and believes in concealed carry and, of course, the Second Amendment. And so that's exactly what you're going to get on this show. This show is entitled Too Many Gun Discussions About Things That Don't Matter. And I'll clarify that a little bit later. In fact, my guest on this show is going to do most of the clarification on that subject. So I'm going to keep this introduction real short. I brought John Hadaway back on the show again, really because I couldn't think of a topic for this week's show. I just had a brain fade, and I thought, what am I going to do? And a couple of days went by. Normally, I start preparing for these shows after I post the last one. I didn't have a subject to talk about. And so I emailed John, and he very graciously said, oh, sure, I can come up with some ideas. And of course, if those of you know John Hadaway or you've heard of him on this show before or on some of the other podcasts out there, John is usually not at a loss for words. Okay, so I'm going to flip the interview on here in just a minute. Just a couple of quick reminders. Become a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network Forum. Also, what you might want to think about doing, if you haven't already, is joining the NRA or the Second Amendment Foundation. And also become a member of IDPA or USPSA. Don't forget to support the shooting sports as well. That's about it. Real quick introduction, because this is a rather long interview. I think you're going to enjoy it, but I don't want this to drag on here as far as commercialism and so forth. So here you go. Quick sound effect. Actually, a quick little public service announcement, pretty much, from the Gun Rights Radio Network. And on the other side of the break, John Hadaway is going to join me about too many gun discussions about things that just don't matter. Stay tuned.
You're about to learn concealed carry secrets that most Americans will never know. With your free subscription to Concealed Carry Report, you will learn how to select the best carry holster, how to know when it's okay to use deadly force, self-defense video of the week, situational awareness tips from fellow subscribers who've had to defend themselves, politically incorrect commentary, unbiased product and gear reviews. Go to www.gunrightsradio.com/USCCA and sign up for your free subscription to Conceal Carry Report.
Okay, folks. Well, for the main topic, I am joined by John Hadaway. He's back on. This is the third time he's been on the Handgun World Show. How you doing, John?
I'm doing great, Bob. And yourself tonight?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for coming back on. Appreciate that. And I want to let everybody know who's listening to this. I emailed John a few days ago, and I said, John, you got to help me. I said, I am all out of topics lately for my show. I can't think of what to do next week, so would you be willing to do an interview? And he graciously agreed to come on. So thanks again for doing this and helping me out.
Bob, I'm more than happy to do this. And hey, just to be a little conciliatory to you, I was standing this last week with three podcasters, all of them talking about how sometimes they just draw a blank on what they're going to do for their show. So you're in good company.
That was me. You know, after I posted the last show, the next day, you know, normally I start preparing the next day for the next show. And I drew a blank, and a couple days went by, and I just couldn't think of anything. So you're going to save the day here.
I'm glad to do it, Bob.
John, I had a few people email me after the last interview you did with me wanting to know a little bit about your background. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit for a couple minutes what you do?
Bob, I'll be happy to. You know, I have an extensive ability to surf the internet. I make all sorts of wild-ass comments, and I base them strictly on conjecture and rumors that I've heard, and I'm the quintessential net ninja. So that's really my qualifications for everything I'm going to say, Bob.
Okay, well, on to my next guest. John, it's been great having you on the show. I appreciate that.
Yeah. No, Bob, I tell you what, I'll just kind of start off with, you know, with the basics. I got introduced to guns at a very early age. My dad was a gun guy. And, you know, I was listening to somebody talk the other day, and I think, you know, I got my first rifle when I was 8 and my first handgun when I was probably, 12 or 13. And, you know, I've always just been kind of a shooter. I started shooting combat pistol or action pistol or whatever word before IBSIC came about in 1979. I shot with Mike Plaxico and some of those early adopters. And, you know, so I had an early exposure to it. And then I went through kind of a long dry spell where I had young children and was broke and just couldn't hardly afford to shoot. And then later on kind of hit the, you know, the 30s and kind of got back into shooting and really got into competition with IDPA. And then decided, you know, now this concealed carry was out here, you could carry your guns. So I started getting some training. And the first person after I got my concealed carry permit that I actually got some formal training from was Masada Yube. And in those days, it was LFI, and I went to LFI 1 and started training in that. That was 1999 when I went to LFI 1. Mm-hmm. Went through LFI 1, 2, 3, and 4, and graduated from 4. Briefly held a couple of records with some of the qualifiers I've shot, which have since been broken. And then, you know, as I progressed along, I do some I'm staff with the Masada Yube group now. I teach with him 2 or 3 times a year, and we attend various events together and you know, do some competitive shooting together. We shoot the nationals together. We'll be in a couple of months. We'll spend some time together at the Polite Society Tactical Conference in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that my good friend Tom Givens puts on.
And, oh yeah,
and you know, I've trained with you know, Jerry Michalak's a friend of mine. I've trained with him before. You know, I've trained with Ernie Langdon before. You know, I've been to various academies and schools, and, you know, I kind of got a box full of training certificates here. I'm also run a security company for my church and run a dignitary protection company. We do some of that. So I've got some details on that I run. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I generally, I guess I've got the gun disease, and you don't cure it. You just treat it with training, ammunition, and guns.
Yeah. And, you know, that's good treatment for it. So when do you sleep?
You know, my wife asks me that question sometimes because she'll come out and I'll be reloading it at 2:30 in the morning in the garage. And she's like, honey, come to bed. I'm like, but I got a match. I got to get going on it. Matter of fact, I'll tell you this. I didn't mention this. I'm also captain of the Nighthawk shooting team that we have here locally. And
nice.
So, you know, I have team practice. And then for Christmas, I actually got my dad a kind of a father-son training class, and we're going to leave this weekend and go over to Memphis to Tom Givens, and my dad and I are going to go through a course together, you know, kind of as his Christmas present. So
that's great.
You know, I spend all my free waking time has something to do with either training or shooting or, you know, working for somebody, doing something with that, or trying to teach someone to do it a little better. And so I'm, that's kind of what I do. And so I've gotten tapped to talk. Matter of fact, I think the next Pro Arms podcast, I'm actually on that, and it's not up yet, but I talked to Gail, and she said she's got the stuff done. I'm talking about my security detail and doing security and dignitary protection on that. So that'll be one of the things that's coming out.
Well, that's an impressive resume, and, you know, that's why I like to have people on like you on here because, you know, I've said it 1,000 times. I'm just an average guy, and I just kind of speak my mind how I see it. But it's good to have people like you from your resume background to talk about this stuff. So let's get into it. Thanks for that intro.
Well, you're more than welcome, Bob. And I got to say, you know, one thing, and Bob, I think this is so true. You know, in my mind, in the gun culture out here, there's really people that fall into a couple of different categories. And, you know, I am the last one to say, you know, we should be self-critical. But, you know, you say you're an average guy, but what's sad is, Bob, is you're probably not an average guy in that you actually shoot and compete and you have an honest intellectual basis that you're looking for knowledge on. And yes. I think, you know, that separates you from a lot of other gun people. And my whole basis that I do these podcasts on and that I train and I do other things is just to try to exhort other people to do exactly what you're doing, which is go shoot a little bit, be involved in the culture, and have an honest mindset to say, you know what, I can go learn something.
Yeah, you know, you're probably right. I guess what I typically mean by that is I'm not some kind of a trainer out there trying to promote a school or doing a couple of training classes each day. But yeah, you know, I get involved or I meant to say a couple of training classes each month. But yeah, I get involved. I go out there, I shoot, and I go out and do it. And you know, my dad always told me, he said, if you're going to talk about something or if you're going to do something or if you're going to try to share something, go do it first, go experience it first, and then you can talk from some kind of a position of credibility. So I appreciate that.
Hey, no problem, Bob.
So let's start with this Ron Avery drill. You know, you sent me a list of topics here to talk about that you wanted to talk about. So what's the Ron Avery drill? Tell us about that.
You know, I was at a Wounded Warrior conference, a tactical conference in Florida, and a bunch of my friends were presenters. And so I was there, you know, I was in town, and Shannon Smith, who's an IDPA master and an IPSC grandmaster, he was there and he was talking about shooting. And the one thing that he put up on there for us to shoot was some of these Ron Avery drills. And Ron has got a drill that is just amazing. And what it is you take one-inch dots, just black one-inch dots. And literally, if you Google print your own targets on the internet, you will come up with 100 people who have targets that are printed out there. And some of them are just black one-inch dots. Mm-hmm. You print them out on a regular sheet of paper. You stand back at maybe 4 yards or even 3 yards, and you shoot one bullet into the center of that black dot. And I don't care if you have a 38 or a 45 or a 9mm, it's humiliating. Bob, it's humiliating because if you're not mastering the correct sight picture, the correct trigger pull, it will expose it every single time. And I got to say that I think if there's one drill when I'm going to go get tuned up for something, I will shoot Ron Avery's drills because you can shoot them in any gun range. They're not expensive, doesn't require a ton of ammunition, and it gives instant feedback on what's going on. And I think, you know, if a guy said, hey, I'm going to go to the range and I've got, you know, 50 rounds that I'm going to be able to shoot out of that, you know, gun I just bought, or I'm going to test it, or I'm going to rent a gun or whatever. You go in, you put up this one sheet of paper, and you shoot these dots. I promise you, you will walk away humiliated. And and I'm saying from a guy who does it all the time, it just brings you back to the fundamentals of sight picture, trigger control. And most of the time, it's trigger control.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just think that's a powerful drill, and I would encourage everyone to try it. And encourage you to try it and, you know, maybe tell me what you think about it. You know, I think that's a challenge that I put out for everybody here, because I think this is one of the things you don't have to spend a lot of money on, but you get great results from and great feedback from.
You know, thanks for saying that, because a listener recently asked me, how do I test a gun? And I know you're going to get in detail in that here in a moment. But, you know, I guess I hope he's listening now, because I guess that's one thing that you can do, not only testing the gun, but that's going to test your marksmanship. I've sort of done that before. What I typically do is, you know, I buy those little inch or inch and a half wide black stickers that turn yellow when you shoot them.
Yep. Yep.
And I put those on targets, and I put it in different places on the target, and I practice shooting at those.
You know, Bob, that's a great thing to do. And I'll tell you something. You know, I used to think there was lots of controlled variables here. And, you know, there's a great drill, you know, transitioning from point to point. But I'm telling you, just going across and having like six dots in a row and try to shoot six dots with perfect holes in the middle of them, you would think, boy, now this is going to be easy.
It's from what distance?
From about 3 yards, maybe less.
Okay.
You would think this is going to be easy. It's just not.
It's not.
It's just really humiliating. So, and then he's got some other drills that are speed drills and other stuff. But the thing I like is that it's really easy to do. It's really consistent. There's not a lot of it's all about the basics. And I think that advanced shooting is not advanced techniques. It's the advanced application of basic techniques. That's what advanced shooting is. And yeah. if you don't have that basic foundation down there, nothing's going to make a difference. Not the gun, not anything. If your finger is not working correctly, nothing else is going to matter to you.
I'm going to try the Ron Avery drill. I'm glad you brought that up. So let's talk about the testing of a gun. Okay. Because elaborate on that. Because like I said, that was a question. I don't think I did a very good job of answering that guy's question. So how would you suggest that somebody test a gun?
You know, Bob, I listened to your show coming back on the airplane, and that was one of the interesting things to me, because I think you've got to ask yourself some questions before you begin testing a gun if you really want to test a gun. Now, mm-hmm. there's a difference between saying, I like a gun, and this is what the gun test revealed to me. Now, let me give you an example. If the gun is a let's just start off and say, I want a gun that is for X purpose. Whatever X is, that's the first thing we need to do, is define the role of that gun. If you don't mm-hmm. define the role of the gun, your testing methodology is going to be flawed. The second thing is to say, what standards should I test this gun to based on its role? So, for instance, if you're going to look at, let's just say, I'm going to look at a self-defense gun. Well, what's important in testing a self-defense gun? Well, I think, first of all, you know, you want to make sure that the gun is reliable. That's going to be one important thing. You're going to want to make sure that it has – now, see, here's where the dilemma comes in. You can make a gun that's 100% reliable, but that's zero accurate. Does that make sense?
Oh, sure, yeah.
I mean, let me tell you what they told me. When I did one of my driving courses, here's what they told me, and I think this applies to guns so much. They said, John, your tires on this car have 100% traction. I said, okay, I'm buying that. They said, you can divide that 100% however you want to, but when you reach 101% of traction available, you then have lost control. And I said, okay. And they said, look, if you're accelerating – and you're only accelerating, you can use 100% of your traction to accelerate with. But now if you turn a corner and you ask for 25% of your traction to turn with, and you're giving 100% acceleration, that's 125%. So you've lost control of the car. Is that making sense, Bob?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So what I'm saying is the same thing would be true if you're turning and braking. And if you use 100% to brake with and 25% to turn with, you're still going to lose control of the car. Okay, a gun is the same way. If I use 100% of the gun for reliability, I'm going to have very little accuracy left, because a gun that's 100% reliable has notoriously loose tolerances to make that gun 100% reliable. Okay, are we following what I'm saying here?
Yeah, I'm following you.
Okay, so what I'm getting at is how much reliability do we need? And how much accuracy do we need? So those two things have to be blended together to make sure that that gun, the reliability versus the accuracy of that gun, have to meet somewhere in the middle for a self-defense gun.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, on the inverse axis of that, if you would, is I look at it and I say, okay, let's say we've got a self-defense gun, right? So now we have to look at the weight and size of the gun versus these other factors. So what I'm saying is, you know, you may go, well, you know, I have this, this gun right here, and it weighs, you know, I have this, what was the huge auto loader? They had the Desert Eagle or whatever, you know.
Desert Eagle.
Yeah. You go, I have this Desert Eagle, and it's this, this, and this. Well, it's not very practical in self-defense situations, because you can't tote that around in your pants all day, right?
Most people probably cannot, I would agree.
You know, but then you go on the other end, and I go, well, I have this North American Arms 22 little bitty tiny revolver that weighs an eighth of an ounce. The ammunition's heavier than the gun. And you go, there might be some problems with, actually stopping someone if you shot them with it. You know, you see where I'm going with this?
Yes.
So I think what you got to do is you've got to come at the things that oppose each other and say, okay, for this purpose, this gun has to fit within these blocks. And so, therefore, my testing criteria should fit within those blocks as well. Now, where I'm going with all this is the second thing I think you have to do is when you begin testing accuracy, when you begin testing reliability, when you begin testing weight and size, you have to say, before I begin this test, here is what I think acceptable reliability is. Is that 500 rounds without a malfunction and without cleaning? Maybe it is. Is it 100 rounds without, you know, any maintenance or oil?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much is that gun is expected to perform versus when do you lubricate and clean that gun? Then you have to say, well, with what ammunition? Is it the ammunition I'm going to carry or is it with this ammunition? So I think that to test a gun, we got to understand the role of the gun, the goals that we have when we test that gun, and then we test to those standards and we measure analytically whether it met those standards or it did not meet that. I will share this with you. I was recently with Mass out in Arizona, mm-hmm. and we were teaching at a Mag 40 class, and there were some people who had been in the gun culture literally one month they had been in the gun culture, I think, and physician, and you know, he asked me some questions and he said, you know, John, this gun, that gun, what about this, what about that? And I tried to do my usual, okay, you're asking me to discuss things that I think really don't matter, but since you're asking and since you're new, I'm going to indulge you in this. So we went through and we talked about the polymer pistols, you know, we went through the whole thing. And he said to me, he said, well, you know, John, this is the next morning after dinner. He said, I talked to so-and-so in the class, and so-and-so said that he tested this M&P9 and for his department, he evaluated it, and the thing just failed miserably. And I looked at him and I said, hey, Doc, let me ask you a question. Yeah. I said, did you ask to read the white paper on it? He looks at me and he says, huh? I said, yeah, you know, he's a Glock guy. And nothing wrong with Glock fanboys or anything, but he didn't like the M&P. And I guarantee you, I can test a Glock and make it choke every single time if you want to watch me do that.
Yeah, I know how to make a Glock choke too, but go on.
And so he went, huh? And I said, so my question is, what was the written criteria for the test to pass fail? I mean, Bob, if I ask you a question, if I said, Bob, you're going to go for your handgun, concealed carry handgun test in the state of Texas, and we're going to have you shoot, but I'm not going to tell you what the standard is before you start, and when you leave, I'm going to say pass, fail, and all you get to do is walk out. How valid a test is that?
That would be a lot of BS.
Exactly. And that's exactly what this guy did, is he established a test that he made the M&P fail, so it got the result he wanted. What I'm saying is I think a lot of people go to the range and they say, I'm going to test this gun. And they do it subjectively, so when they're there testing, well, this feels pretty good. This seems reasonable today. This seems this. This seems that. What I'm saying to you is you should have a methodology that you test the gun to, and mm-hmm. then, you know, go from there. I know, for instance, talk about accuracy and talk about bench, you know, whether you put it in a ransom rest or use a bench or whatever. Mm-hmm. Masad Ayoub says this. He says, what I do is he says, I get a good two-handed grip on the gun and I shoot it from, and I can't remember the distance. And he says, I take the best three out of the five rounds and measure that. And he said, I've tested that against ransom rest. And it seems to prove to me that those tell me that that eliminates my inaccuracy on the gun. And that tells me how accurate the gun is. Well, okay. You know what? I've not tested guns for a living, but he has. Seems pretty reasonable to me that he's developed a system that works for him that lets him talk about the accuracy of the gun that he does for a living. He does that for a living. So right. what I'm saying, though, is that at least he has a standard, you know, and he tests it with different ammunition, and he can say this ammunition did this and this did this. And that's all I'm saying. When you test a gun, is you can't go to the range and test a gun unless you have at least brought a sheet of paper with you and said, these are the tests I'm going to ask this gun to perform. I'm going to record the results. I'm going to tabulate them when I get back, And that will be the basis of my test for the gun.
Yeah, and I think something you might have forgot to mention, too, is that I think it really depends on, is this a target gun? Is this a concealed carry gun? You know, what are you going to ask it to do? You alluded to that in the beginning. And I think that the test for a target gun might be a lot different than the test for a carry gun. Would you agree?
You know what? I got to tell you. And I didn't hit that very hard, Bob, but that's a great point. You know, my car PM9 is going to shoot what I consider to be accurate than, say, for instance, you know, a 5-inch 1911, you know, or insert whatever gun you want to put in there that has a much longer barrel, much better trigger, you know, all these other things with it, because the gun is designed, and that's where I talked about it earlier, you know, what is the role and what is the goal? Those are the two things that you got to start off with to validate your testing. So you're exactly right.
Yeah. Okay, good. So that's good education there on testing a gun. That's excellent. Those car PM9s are accurate, aren't they?
You know what? They really are. I got to say, I shoot mine not as much as I should. I'm going to confess that right up front. But I never worry that the gun will not deliver. You know?
I know. Oh, I know. I love it. You know, I absolutely love mine. I would have to say it's one of the most accurate handguns that I own. And I've shot that thing actually out to 20 yards. And if I practice good trigger control, and with that long double action trigger, you have to, it's amazing what you can do with that little short barrel out to 20 yards.
You know, I'll tell you something. It's got good sights on it from the factory. Mm-hmm. It's got good
yes,
sights.
Yes, it does.
And the gun is accurate, and it does what you ask it to do. And that trigger, one thing I'll point out, I actually like the trigger on my car better than I do on most of my other polymer guns, because it's a metal trigger and it doesn't wobble. You know what I'm talking about, Bob? I mean, that trigger,
yeah.
It's like a revolver trigger. It's not like a polymer frame gun trigger.
Yeah, and it doesn't wobble, and it's smooth, and it breaks very clean.
Yes, so, but you know what? They're expensive, but you pay for what you get.
I don't really think they're all that expensive. I mean, you know, I mean, they're only about maybe $120, $130 more than most average polymer guns.
Well, you know, or you could buy a dozen Kel-Tex. I mean, take your pick.
Uh-oh, we won't go there. All right, so that was good stuff on how to test a gun. Now, you also sent me something that says, too many discussions about things that don't matter. I'm really intrigued to hear what you have to say about this.
You know, Bob, I picked this up from listening to podcasts, and I'm going to say not just the ones on the Gun Rights Radio Network. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I listen to a lot of podcasts about guns. And I'm going to tell you that what I think we get into is this. We get into a discussion about things that don't matter. Let me give you a couple of them that don't matter.
Okay.
I'm not saying they don't exist. Hear me on this. They exist. Everything here is real, but I don't think it matters. For instance, one of my favorites, my 1911 points differently than my Glock.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So, what's your point? Well, that darn Springfield XD has a grip safety on it. I don't know about that. Or, you know, you can buy an M&P with a thumb safety on it. Yeah. You know what? You can learn to operate both of them.
Well, now, wait a minute. Now you're getting me on that one, because I've complained about the grip safeties on Springfield XDs. But
well,
go on.
Well, wait a minute. let me run through this. How about this is one of mine. You know, I love a SIG 226. XDMPSR, you know, insert whatever arithmetic and alphabet that SIG puts on their guns. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that darn safety, no, it doesn't have a safety. It has a decocker.
A decocker, yeah.
Oh, that it's evil. Or my favorite, you know, I just, my thumb catches the slide release on a SIG and I just can't shoot one.
Yeah. You know, well, you know, and you're right. All this stuff doesn't matter, because my thumb has caught the slide release on a Glock before, and I just changed my grip, and I just burned that into my memory, and guess what? No more problem.
Wait a minute. Did you say your thumb safety on your slide release on a Glock? Your thumb caught that? How can that be on a Glock? I thought they didn't have issues.
There is no such thing as perfection. You know, that's a good marketing tool, yeah. But yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, I used to do that, especially in IDPA shoots all the time. You know, my strong hand thumb would be riding real close to that gun, and sometimes during recoil, I'd accidentally hit that magazine, that slide release, and I'd have a problem with that, so I had to change my grip.
You know, so where I'm going with this, Bob, is this. You know, I have this little maxim that I kind of throw out here for people. Okay, Bob, here's my question. Do you know what the difference between a conviction and a preference is?
Between a conviction and a preference?
Correct.
No, what is it?
A conviction is anything you're willing to die for, and everything else in this world is a preference. Now, what I'm saying to you is, Bob, is that these things that we spend lots of time discussing, to me, fall into training issues. You know, I can take any shooter with any gun, period. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if I invest some training with that shooter, usually less than an hour, I can have them up and running. And if they'll use that gun, I don't know, you know, once a month occasionally with the training that I've given them, they can operate that gun and pretty soon they master it. Now, what I'm saying is that we spend lots and lots and lots, endless amounts of brain cells and hours discussing hardware. And my point to you is that as much as the gun manufacturers would love for us to believe that this gun will be the problem solver, it's a software issue, Bob.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, one of my pet peeves, sorry to interrupt you there, John. One of my pet peeves is, well, there's two of them. When people talk about grip angle, and the other is when they talk about caliber. Those two things just drive me nuts because I think out of everything you've mentioned so far, those are the two that don't matter the most.
Yeah. And Bob, let me go one step further for you. You know, I know you've talked about, I don't like the grip safety on the XD, okay?
Yeah, I've said that, yeah.
Now, Bob, I have preferences, okay? I'm going to freely admit to you that in a polymer gun, my preference is the Smith & Wesson M&P series of guns, okay? It mm-hmm. just is.
They're good guns.
You know, but my preference is based on some things that I like, but I don't think the XD is a bad gun. I don't think the Glock is a bad gun. And I can give you some reasons to justify my preference. But I got to mm-hmm. tell you, if I walked into a war zone and they said, this is the only gun you're authorized to carry, take this or take nothing. Gee, Bob, I bet you'd put that XD in your holster pretty quick, wouldn't you?
Hell yeah.
And I surely would put a Glock in my holster pretty quick because given my preferences, my convictions will win out every time, right? Which is to stay alive.
Yeah. Okay. I'll put a 1911 in my holster if that's the only thing available.
You know what? You might not even put it in that. What kind of holster was it you were talking about you got some samples of?
High Noon holsters. I got two of them.
You know, you ought to help a brother out. I'd evaluate that PM9 holster for you if you wanted a second opinion.
Well, I might do that. I'm evaluating the High Noon Hideaway. As a matter of fact, I got it on right now. It's fabulous. I'll go ahead and I'll leak a little bit of my review that I'm going to do. This High Noon Hideaway for a PM9 appendix carry is tremendous.
Really?
Yeah, it really is. I would say for that gun, it's the best appendix carry holster out there. For a Glock, I'm really partial to the Dale Fricke Archangel, but for the Car PM9, this Hideaway is incredible.
You know, I got to tell you, appendix carry is something that I've looked at, and you know, if you can do appendix carry, it is dirty fast on a self-defense gun.
Yeah, I can do it. I can get away with this. Matter of fact, I made, probably four or five business calls today, appendix carrying each one of them.
Good, good. Well, that's good to hear. You know, I've got some holsters with that Car PM9 that I've carried, and you know, I usually end up with it with the Uncle Mike's pocket carry holster mm-hmm. in the front pocket, you know, left or right front pocket. But, you know, there are times where I'll tuck that one of my other cars into an inside the pants crossbreed, or I've used some Comptax or some other stuff out there. But I'm always looking, you know, for a good holster for those cars. So that's good to hear. I'm glad to hear that.
I might even send it to you for a second opinion. Let's see what happens.
Hey, we can work through that, Bob.
What else doesn't matter that people talk about?
You know, I think there's some other stuff that let's put it this way. I love a good trigger on a gun. I am king of a good trigger on a gun. But I had a gunsmith over at Nighthawk challenged me on some stuff because I said, this is how I want my trigger. And he handed me a trigger and he said, shoot this one, John. And I played with it. And I said, you know, I don't know that I like this and I don't know this. And he said, you know, shoot it. Carry it. Mm-hmm. Shoot it in a match. Try it. See what you think. I said, okay, fine. And the way the trigger worked was a little different, that it actually almost had a little roll to the break instead of it breaking clean. And mm-hmm. I began shooting it. I was like, I can't tell a difference. And he goes, I didn't think so. And what it boiled down to is this. You give me my M&P, and I'm telling you, box stock M&P trigger, you give me one of those, and after, you know, 50 or 100 rounds from transitioning from my 1911s that I'm carrying, hey, mm-hmm. I'm on with it too. You give me a Glock, besides the web of my hand bleeding, 100 rounds, I'm on with it. You give me mm-hmm. an XD, 100 rounds, I'm on with it. You give me a Glock with a New York one trigger in it, I'm on with 100 rounds after that. I mean, mm-hmm. where I'm going with this is we spend a lot of time talking about trigger pull, when in reality, it's how do we operate our finger that matters a whole lot more than the trigger that's in the gun. Now, you get into competition, I do believe there are some things that you can say, I can get away with this, and it may make my score better. But that's a different discussion when we're talking about things that don't matter, really. It's, you know, if you know how to operate a trigger, whether it's a 1.2-pound telekinetic trigger or an 8-pound Glock New York 1 trigger, mm-hmm. it's a training issue, Bob. It's not a hardware issue.
Well, you know, I would agree with you on that for the most part. You know, especially competition shooting. Let me speak to all the competition shooters out there. I've seen people with a Glock, a standard Glock trigger, unmodified whatsoever, kick the crap out of somebody that had this, you know, Ghost Rocket, highly polished 2.3-ounce slicked up short reset trigger, you know, because the guy with the stock Glock trigger knew what he was doing. He knew how to control that trigger. He's probably practiced with it, and he beat the other guy. You know, I mean, I've seen yep. that.
Hey, I can tell you that those are things that we talk about that don't matter. And what I'm saying is that if we really want, you know what, I guess where I'm going with this, Bob, is I think what we're doing is we're addressing the symptoms, not the problem. And we're addressing the symptoms with things that don't matter rather than addressing the problem, which is our own training and our own habituation to what our preference is rather than what we should be addressing, which is, look, you know what? I'm the only variable in this equation. That gun's going to do the same thing every time. Why don't I fix me instead of fixing that toaster that's laying in front of me, you know? I mean, that would be the equivalent of us saying, well, you know, in the morning, you know, I push down on the toaster and my thumb slips off, so I'm going to go buy a new toaster. Well, why don't we just use our forefinger and push down on it with that? You know what I'm saying? It's like, gee, that seems much simpler to me, and it might work on every toaster we have, you know?
Yeah. Well, now let me ask you about this. Is this something that we talk about that really doesn't matter? There's something else I want to add to it. How about sights?
You know, Bob, I'll tell you what. I think that sights fall into a category that they can matter. Now, let me give you an example of where I'm going with this. I heard an interesting term this last week, and I'm going to share it with you in self-defense context. Okay. It was, when you're in the fight and you got metal over meat, you can get away with wanking the trigger. Okay? Well, I'm saying to you, it's when I look up and I got metal over meat, do my sights matter to me much?
No, they don't matter at all.
Exactly. Now, but if I am shooting at, say, 12 to 15 yards, or maybe even 7 to 12 yards, and I have to shoot something in a very small box because they're holding something that I love in their hands and have a knife, do sights matter, Bob?
Yeah, that's not quite what I mean, though. What I meant is the type of sights.
Well, now that's where I'm going to, because I can tell you this. I think that there are some sights that to me, okay, now I know I'm about to step on toes here, but you know the big dot sites. I'm not going to name names here, but all of them for me fall into the same category. They're great up close, but if I want to do precision work at 7 to 10 yards, they don't work for me. Now, Does that mean they don't work for you, Bob? No, I didn't say that. I said they don't work for me. Well, here's the other thing. You know, what does work for me is, you know, the fiber optic side in the front. Boy, that really draws my eye in and works really well for me. Now, other people, man, they have to have, you know, a set of posts and notch that are traditional that, you know, well, I'm saying here is I do think with our eyesight, with the some people wear glasses, some people are cross-eyed dominant, some people have astigmatism. You know, there's so many things that go on there. I do, in fact, think that the right pair of sights can make the difference or can be tremendously bad for shooters. So I think sights are one of those things where I go, you know, yeah, they could make a big difference. Now, let me clarify something. I know people who say, well, you know, I got night sights on this gun and da-da-da-da-da, and I have a orange back and a green front, or I got a green front and I got this thing and that thing.
Right.
I don't know that night sights – look, I don't take night sights off guns if I have them on there, okay? I leave them on. You know, I'm not saying this. But I've found doing lots and lots of shooting in the dark that night sights are not the end-all and be-all – that people think they are. Matter of fact, I was match director for the Nighthawk Custom Indoor Challenge. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of good shooters. Jerry Mishlak came up, a bunch of masters and grandmasters came and shot. And we had four stages in the dark. And there was lots of crashing and burning. And one of them, we did the standards, you know, where you have to shoot. You shot standards in IDPA before, you know, you stand up and shoot, you move forward and shoot, you move forward and shoot.
Right.
Well, we did that, except we did it in the dark. And so it was kind of interesting to have people start off in a very, very low light situation and have to shoot the same standards in the dark. I mean, you'd see people dump 100 points on a stage that literally should, you know, you should shoot in 30 seconds with, you know, zero down. And they dump 100 points on it. Had night sights on their gun. Well, night sights don't teach you to shoot in the dark. Training does. So, you know, we had other stages where you started seated, you retrieved your gun, and all of a sudden there was the most obnoxious music you've ever heard in your whole life, and you had a strobe light going on. So now you got a night sight with a strobe light going behind you. You can't use night sights. It's in that environment. You can't. They don't help. They don't make any difference because your eyes are strobing with this light.
Yeah, so, the strobe light just screws up your vision like crazy.
Yeah, I know. I enjoyed that. I had lots of complaints on that stage. Anyway, where I'm going with this is I think sights are one of those things that can make a difference. Night sights, however, are way too heavily relied on by people, and I don't think – I think they help, but I don't think they are a substitute for training in the dark with a gun. And imagine this. Don't most self-defense shootings occur in low-light situations?
Yeah, they do. You know, in night sights, I forgot who it was that said it, but somebody made a really good point. If it's so dark that you can't see your target, you're not going to be able to see your sights much either.
Exactly.
And even if you do have night sights, okay, let's say you can see your sights because they're glowing in the dark. If you can't see your target, you shouldn't be pulling the trigger. What the hell are you shooting at if you can't see your target?
Exactly. You know, you kind of need to make sure you know what that is that you're shooting at.
Right.
And that's part of what I guess. So to answer your question, yes, I think sights can make a significant difference, but I don't think, again, that sights cure training issues.
Yeah, I might take issue with one thing. I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't think sights make as big of a difference as a lot of people say. And I have read stuff on the internet, and I've heard people say, oh, you know, I trash those sights and I don't use them anymore because I shot like crap with them. And I'd be willing to bet that probably the reason they shot like crap with them, like you said, is more software than it is the actual sights. Even with the big dot sights, there are people that are fantastic with those sights at 25 yards if you know how to shoot them.
And I am not one of those people who know how to shoot them. I will freely admit to you, Bob, that if that's all I had on my gun, I'd probably get better real quick because I'd work at them. But
you'd work at it.
I guess part of it is too, Bob, and I'm going to be frank about this. You know, I pretty much usually shoot whatever comes on the gun, and I just work with it. The big dot sights up until a few years ago didn't come on the guns at all. And so I just, you know, tried them out, didn't like them, didn't want to spend my money on something that I didn't feel good about right up front. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why I've never habituated myself to doing that. But I guarantee you, if somebody handed me a gun and they had big dot sights on it and that's all I had, I'd sure want to know how to shoot them and I'd sure work at it.
Did you ever try to shoot the sights that come on a Glock?
You know, I have, as a matter of fact.
How'd that work?
Not real well. I'll tell you. Again, I confess to you, you know, I'm not a Glock guy. But I usually will change the plastic sights to metal sights, you know, of some kind. And my favorite aftermarket sights are the either the Savigny sight or the 10-8 sights.
I love the Warren Savigny sights. I've got them on my Glock 34 and on one of my Glock 19s. I think they're fantastic.
I think they make great sights, you know.
But I shoot black on black. You know, I had somebody in a match one time to me say, "How can you shoot black on black? Don't you need a fiber optic?" No, the way I learned to shoot is black front, black rear. I'm a notch and post guy. Maybe that's old fashioned, but that's the way I learned, and those work real well for me.
You know, I got to tell you, when it comes down to it, there are lots of times where I think the black on black is the way to go. And on a lot of my 1911 guns, you know, I'm black on black and that's it. You know, no night sight, no fiber optic, no nothing. And, you know, I don't feel bad or anything shooting those. You know, matter of fact, I'll tell you something. If I get a set of sights that have a white dot on them, no tritium insert, I'll use sight black on them. And black them out, because I don't like the white interfering with what I'm shooting.
Yeah, well, you know, Dave Savigny is not too bad with a piece of crap plastic Glock and black on black sights. He's won a few championships before.
He has. Now Bob Vogel's not too shabby with a Glock either, you know?
No, he's not too shabby with a Glock either. That's true. So, and since we're on the subject of Glocks, okay, I know it's not your favorite pistol. That's fine. It's my favorite, and that's okay. It works for me. It doesn't work for you. One of the things that you sent me on your agenda here is you want to talk about the myth of the Glock and about Glocks that have had failures.
You know, let's go through this for a minute. This is the interesting part to me. I think that we, as you know, I've always said this, is, you know, we should get to the position where we love people and we use things. But unfortunately, we tend to love things and use people. And what I'm getting at here is we love our Glocks, but because we love our Glocks, we don't really take an analytical look at our Glock and say what's going on. Now, let me tell you why I'm saying this. When we were at the Mag 40 class, I actually kept a little log of all the guns that got pulled off the line for failures and all the guns that had failures. Mm-hmm. Now, one gun that was brought in broken, okay, I want to tell you this right up front. The gun came in broken. It never functioned. It had to be pulled off the line. And honestly, he was handed a Glock, and he shot the rest of the course with a Glock. But it was a Ruger, okay? And it was a Ruger. It was kind of a – I know they don't make it anymore, but it was what, the P85 variant of the Ruger, you know, kind of big, blocky, stainless steel, you know, usually like a brick. Okay, this thing – would not run, and actually they called Ruger. Ruger overnighted them the parts, and they fixed his gun for him and gave it back to him. But and the class took up a collection and bought him a Glock. So, you know, who knows? anyway, I actually contributed to that. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm a hypocrite, but the guy actually, I tell you, I'll tell you who it was. It was Joe Zamudo. I don't know if you know Zamudo.
That sounds familiar.
Well, he was the guy that had the concealed carry permit that came up on the shooting in Arizona.
Joe Zamudio. Zamudio. Sorry. That's why he sounds familiar. The guy that, one of the responders in the Gifford shooting. That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Matter of fact, he showed that Ruger. I saw him in an interview. He showed that big, huge Ruger he was carrying.
Yeah, well, that came to the line broken. So, but back to my story about the Glock. Okay, after you take out that Ruger, do you realize that every failure that had to be taken off the line was a Glock after that?
It doesn't surprise me because I've said many times Glocks can and do fail. And I think that anybody that gets on the internet or starts talking about my Glock never fails, I think they're lying.
Now, let me share something with you.
Or they don't shoot enough, one of the two.
Exactly. Do you know the Glocks that came off the line as failures had aftermarket barrels in them?
Well, sure. That makes sense.
Do you also know that some of the Glocks that came off the line that were failures, it was related to, crappy ammunition maybe?
Yeah.
You know, well, yep. Here's where I'm going with this, Bob. You know, I don't think the Glocks are perfect. I think that they have lots of failures. I think that people choose to ignore those failures. I think that it has gotten to the point that Glocks are so prolific now that literally when Glock first came out and they had all this accuracy, it was because they were all box stock. They all had loose tolerances. Well, why do you put an aftermarket barrel in your Glock? I mean, seriously, I only know of two reasons. Do you know of a third one?
The only two reasons I can think of is in case you want to shoot different ammo, if you want to shoot lead ammunition.
Yeah, that's number one.
And then the second reason is if you want to change the caliber of it.
Well, besides caliber changes, to get more accuracy out of it.
I don't believe that gets you more accuracy. I really don't.
I'm not saying that it does. I'm saying that that's the reason.
Yeah.
I didn't say got cause effect. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, here's my point. What they do is that barrel, all those aftermarket barrels are actually out of tolerance for the Glock so that they push up against that locking block that's in there.
Right.
And they tighten the gun up. Well, when you tighten that gun up, remember when I talked about testing? You know, you can only have 100% of something, so what do you give to get something else?
Right.
All of a sudden, ammunition that's slightly out of tolerance will no longer work in that Glock, which is the hallmark of that reliability because they wanted more accuracy.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, you know, let me ask you to back up for a minute. Don't you think barrels could also be one of those things that we talk about that don't matter?
Yeah.
Okay, keep going.
Listen, I'll tell you something. My favorite thing, is somebody goes, yeah, I put a Storm Tiger Paw Glock Extreme Duty Wear barrel in this gun, and it'll shoot 0.000 groups at the surface of the moon. Okay, tell you what. Why don't you just shoot me about 5 shots here, isosceles at 15 yards. Let's just warm up with that. Go down range. Hey, I'm counting most of them here on paper. What happened here? Well, you know, wait a minute. Hold on. We couldn't hit with a stock barrel, so we changed the stock barrel out to this other barrel, and you still don't hit the target real well. What's up with this? You know what I'm saying here? So
it's a software thing. And but let me ask you about these Glocks that are failing. Are they all Glocks that, or most of them, are they Glocks that have been modified?
You know, I because I didn't break it down, mm-hmm. I saw several of them with aftermarket barrels that literally were taken apart with a hammer, okay, to get the ammunition mm-hmm. out. I yep. saw some that I couldn't tell but once I took them apart, I actually drove the round back out of them, and mm-hmm. you could see where the round the brass was actually being shredded as it came off the magazine into the barrel. So it was actually peeling a portion of that off, which told me it had a burr of some kind or there was some problem with it when I got the gun apart. You know, now what I'm saying is, I don't know whether it was the ammunition they were shooting out of it or whether it was some modification they had made to the gun. But I know that the best score in the class for accuracy was shot with a Glock 17 with a barrel that had been changed out so the guy could shoot his cast reload bullets that he shot out of it.
Yeah.
Now, he shot the best group out of the class, beating me, by the way. And so I'm like, you know, so what am I saying here? I'm saying that the Glocks are absolutely no different than any other gun out there. There's just a myth. And that myth is something that let's don't stake our life on. You know, that's all I'm saying about Glocks. I'm not saying they're a bad gun. I'm not saying that you shouldn't carry one. I'm not saying any of that. I'm saying it's a myth that they don't fail. It's a myth that you don't have to lubricate them. It's a myth that you don't have to clean them. Those things have to be done to the Glock. They may not be as sensitive as a 1911. And by the way, I don't know if you read Masada Yube's blog on the I think it's on the Back Home.
Backwoods Home. Occasionally I look at it, yeah.
Well, his one now, he's actually got a deal in there about this exact thing. And where he talks about someone who had jams and he was shooting reloaded ammunition with a gun show. Well, here's the deal. That guy that had that problem started off, he was shooting a Springfield Armory GI 1911 in 45, okay? The gun, now this is the finest 1911 you can buy for under $400. So what happened was is the little piece on the side of the gun that holds the slide release and the thumb safety in place, it has that little plunger inside of it. It came unstaked from the gun. So I said, look, we're going to take it back off the line. I'm going to see if I can fix it for you. Here, take my Nighthawk in 45 and shoot it. Now, while I was there, Eric Shelton had his girlfriend there, and he said, would you work with her to teach her to shoot? And as a side note, I think she's got a lot more potential than Eric does. But anyway...
somehow I knew that was coming.
Well, the thing is, she listens to instruction. I mean, you know, she's easy to teach. But and she,
Eric, I didn't set him up for this, okay?
Well, the thing is you say, dump your magazine on the ground. She pushes the mag release button. They hit the ground. Eric, on the other hand, wants to gently put them on the ground. I don't know, you know? So anyway,
I've heard him talk about that.
Yeah, so anyway... They come over to me and say, John, your gun's jamming. He's having problems with it. I said, okay, fine. I said, bring it back. So I brought my gun back off the line. I walked over. I ran about 50 rounds through it with no problem. No problems. I said, okay. So I walked back over there. I look in the box, the ammo can that he's shooting it out of. I pick up the ammunition. You can see basically a pre-split line on the case going out where it's bulged on the side of it. So I said to the shooter, I said, where did you get this ammunition? It's reloads. I got it at the gun show. I said, well, number one, you're not shooting it out of my gun anymore. I don't have a bias against reloads. I reload my own ammunition. I do not have a bias against people who reload their own ammunition and know what it is. Well, Mass actually has something in his blog about this. His exact words are that, let's see, there were lessons of importance of using the right equipment. One shooter in the first level Mag 40 class came to grief with constant gun malfunctions until we determined that he had been shooting reload ammunition, which he had bought at a gun show. I had to explain to him that gun show reloads are to ammunition what crack whores are to women. Lesson learned for him, lesson affirmed for me and the rest of the Mag 40 teaching staff. He's talking about me letting people shoot reloads out of my gun without finding out what they are. So, you know, where I'm at on this is, gee, we fixed the ammunition. Now, was that a 1911 that was a Jam Master? No. It was bad ammunition. Were those Glocks huge failures and should be thrown into the wood line? No.
No.
They had failures due to ammunition and aftermarket equipment.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between a Glock and a 1911 there? You know, I'm saying... Okay, send me the hate mail. Go ahead and send it if you must. But I'm saying that both of them are mechanical devices, and they both malfunction. The difference is one of them has a myth around it that it doesn't, but it does.
I will agree that Glocks do fail. They can and do fail. In fact, I can make a Glock fail 4 times out of 5. It's not that hard to do. And I leave mine in stock configuration except for the sights. That's, you know, I messed around with all that aftermarket crap. I had aftermarket barrels and aftermarket connectors and aftermarket magazine release buttons. And I had, you know, I was rebuilding half the damn gun at one point in time. And finally, you know what? It didn't make me a better shooter. I got rid of all that crap. I went back to stock configuration on the Glocks, except for the sights, and they run fine. But I'm not going to lie and say they run perfect because they don't.
And you know, Bob, I think that's intellectually honest. And I think that lots of people who talk about Glock perfection and to Glock this and Glock that, you know, I just wish that they would say, okay, you know what? Here's my log of the last 500 rounds that I fired.
Mm-hmm.
and show it to me. And if they say, you have 5,000 rounds without a malfunction, I always ask this question, can I see your log? Well, I don't keep a log. Really? Then how do you know? Well, I remember. Okay, so what ammunition did you shoot? What magazines did you shoot? What did, you know, wait a minute, hold on. You know, what were your intervals of cleaning? So I'm just saying, look, they're great guns. They're great priced. They're a great value. There's lots of good things, but they're not perfect.
No, they're not perfect. And, you know, I would just say to people that out of all the guns that I've owned, and this is just me, this might not be other people's experiences, your mileage might vary, they have failed the least. They failed the least. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Out of all the guns that I've owned. I got to tell you, though, surprisingly enough, my Car PM9's a very close second.
You know, I got to say, my cars, if I said, what's the most most trouble-free gun, I'd have to say that was probably one of them right there. You know, it really does. You know, hey, one thing I was going to, I thought about, if you don't mind me changing gears here, you know, I heard on your show, you were talking about range guns and renting them and people ripping you off with the price of ammunition. And, you know, I'm going to go ahead and say, Bob, that's a gimme. You know, there are people out there that are going to rip you off with, you know, different things, and I'm not going to sit here and defend anything, but I did want to illuminate something for you, I think, on the other side of that equation. Now, let me say this. I don't own a gun store. I don't sell guns for a living. I, however, spend lots of times with people who do own gun stores, who do own gun ranges, and who do have rental guns. So I've spent enough time around that I might have a little different perspective, but I was going to give you a few little fun facts about range guns you may or may not know. You ready?
Okay. Yeah, I'm ready. Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, most of those range guns are bought on a specific range gun program that have different parameters to them. Some of those parameters limit what ammunition you can shoot in those guns if you decide to buy it and adhere to that range gun program. So, for instance, Glock has a program, and I think it's you can buy any Glock you want to for like $300 and get it on the range gun program, but you have to keep it and rent it for a year. You have to report how many rounds are shot out of it, any failures that occur, and it does limit the ammunition that you can shoot through that gun.
Really? So in other words, their rental contract
may not let you shoot something other than their ammunition? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Their rental contract may, at one time, did specify the ammunition they could and could not shoot through that gun.
Okay, well, I didn't know that. And if that's the case, then I'll stand corrected on that. I just, it'd be nice if they'd at least lower the price of their rental ammunition a little bit, you know?
Yeah, well, Bob, here's the thing. I am not saying that Glock does that, okay? I'm saying that I know other companies that do specify what ammunition can and cannot be shot out of that gun, according to the range agreements. Now, where I'm also going with this is people who rip you off on ammunition for range guns are really doing themselves a disservice because they're making money renting that gun.
Exactly.
And they should sell you ammunition at a relatively reasonable price. The only thing I was also going to point out to you about people who have shooting ranges is this. You know, if you have a shooting range and you rent guns, but you can't get any ammunition because your distributors don't have any of it, and you have to go to, say, Walmart or, you know, Academy or whoever's selling ammunition and has some, and you have to buy it and pay sales tax on it and then mark it up again to cover your overhead, it may look exorbitant. You may not really be ripping somebody off. There was a period of time a year or two ago when that was the case. I know because people who owned the ranges would ask me because they knew that I went, you know, was in a lot of Walmart stores. They would say, John, you know, here's $500. You're going to be out making stores this week. If you see any ammunition, please buy it and bring it back to me just so I can stay in business. So, you know, I know that there was a period of time when no one had any ammunition and even cheap, you know, Winchester white box stuff was hard to get and expensive when they got it. And so, you know, that I know drove people to charge way too much for ammunition.
Yeah, but my comment about that was in the context of today. We don't really have that much of a shortage of ammo anymore.
Agreed.
And, You know, like, for example, the local range near me, they charge $10 to rent a gun, any of the gun, which I think is actually a pretty good price.
Yep.
If you're a member of the range, they charge $10 to rent a gun. If they rent that gun out 10 times in 1 month, that's $100 that they've made to rent out that gun. Let's say it's a Glock 19, for example. You know, has that gun lost $100 worth of value in that month? No, but the range has made $100. The least they could do is give me a break on ammunition, don't you think?
You know, I absolutely agree with you. I will tell you this. I do not, by no means am I supporting the guy charging you $25 for a $15 box of ammunition. You know, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I'm by no means, I'm just saying, the guy who also is renting out that Glock, you know what else he's got to put up with, though, is this. He's got to clean that gun. Maybe. Maybe not. It's Glocked. I don't know. Do they need to be cleaned? I don't know.
Yes, they do. That's another myth, by the way. That's another myth about Glocks. Since you're on that subject, they do need to be cleaned. Yes, they do.
You know, so he's got to clean the gun, and he's got to, you know, keep a record of what's going on, and he's got to, you know, maintain that range. And listen, I know what you're saying, and I'm not defending that at all. I just was throwing out to you that for that guy to have those guns out there, he does have agreements with the people he's renting those guns out for, basically.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, almost every manufacturer has a range gun program.
Okay, and thanks for clarifying that, because I didn't know that. And if they're just adhering to their program, then I understand. And maybe it's part of the program that they have to shoot, they have to make people shoot the ammunition sold in the store. Maybe that is part of it.
Now, here's the other thing I'm just going to tell you. I have actually seen – let me tell you why I say this too. And I want to share this little story with you, and then you're going to go, John, are you for real? And I'm going to go, uh-huh, I'm for real. Guy came in one time, and I was standing in the store when I watched all this happen. He said, yeah, I want to rent that Glock 23 down there. Okay, that's fine. He came back a little bit, and he goes, yeah, you know, this gun is not working. I said, sir, what do you mean it's not working? Now, I'm on the customer side of the counter, because when somebody comes in and says, Glock's not working, you know, my ears perk up. I want to hear what's not working. And he goes, well, you know, I shoot it one time, and then it cycles, but it won't feed, and I have to manually cycle. I said, really? So I'm looking at it, and I said, are you limp-wristing it? And he, no, I'm holding it like this, and I'm that. And he said, come on, look at me, shoot it. I said, okay. Sure enough, loads the gun up. Bang! Okay. Look at it. Gun doesn't, you know, sort of cycles, won't feed. Bang! I said, hold on, let me look at this a second. Looked at it, got the magazine out. I said, sir, where'd you get this ammunition? I brought it in with me. I said, oh, well, I tell you what, you need to come out here and buy some ammunition. Why? I said, well, this gun's 40, and this is 9mm ammunition.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I've also seen them do the same thing in a Glock 21 with 40 caliber ammunition.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's dangerous.
Now, here's what I'm getting at. For the guy who's renting that gun, if he sells you the ammunition, he at least knows what you're feeding that thing.
Well, yes. And again, my point when I said that on the show was not that I had a problem with them requiring that I use their ammo. I have a problem with them charging so much for it. And
I agree.
If I was a gun store owner, I would think, I mean, you know, hey, I'm a sales guy, and I'm a business guy, and I think about business. And you know, I have to say I've never run a gun store, but my business mind says to me, okay, if I want people to rent guns, two things are going to happen. Number one, I'm going to make money on the rentals, but number two, I'm probably going to sell more guns because they're renting them.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to encourage them. I'm going to encourage them to come in and rent by giving them a discount on ammo. As a matter of fact, I might even put up a sign that says 10% discount on ammo if you rent a gun.
Yep. I agree with
that. But they don't do that. They actually charge you full price for the ammo.
Yeah, I know. Hey, Bob, I'm with you. You know, things that make sense to me don't make sense in all universes. But those little stories, I thought, you know, made some interesting fodder when we were talking about renting guns at gun stores, you know.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad you put those in there. I'm glad you put the, and I didn't know about the rental gun program. So, thanks for enlightening me about that. So, on your notes here, you also want to talk about your win at the Wounded Warrior match.
Yeah, you know, I spent some time with Mass, and Gail was there, and John Strayer, who's a friend of mine, Terry Strayer, and we went down there for a really good cause. which was the Wounded Warriors. And, you know, Bob, I'll say this. There's very few things in this world that I get, you know, really passionate about supporting and, you know, putting my money towards, I guess because I'm cynical most of the time. But the Wounded Warrior thing, these guys put on a great conference. They put on some great matches. They had great world-class trainers. And I'm going to tell you something. Everybody donated everything, and every penny they raised went directly to the Wounded Warriors. And I think they gave a check for like $10,000 for like 70 guys, you know, on a 2-day event. It was just incredible. And I got to say, you know, I was impressed with the level of training, but to do that, to support the Wounded Warriors, and, you know, we're talking about guys who have come back after serving our country, and, you know, they're not the same. They've left part of themselves somewhere else, and that's what the Wounded Warrior goes to support. And great cause, great time. It was down in Florida, and I had a great time and learned some stuff down there. They had Andy Sanford down there. They had Shannon Smith down there. They had a SWAT doctor, an actual doctor who's part of, I think it's Miami's SWAT team or the county there, Dade County SWAT team. They had Masada Yub. They had a couple other guys down there, some great training, great time, and had a couple of really decent matches down there. So had a great time, good cause. And I'm actually going to try to do something similar to that here in Northwest Arkansas to put on a Wounded Warrior event. I'm right now lining up the trainers, and I've got the venue kind of reserved. And so I'm going to try to get some big-name people to come in and help me put it on and raise some money for a good cause.
Well, congratulations on your win, and I see a picture of this AR-15 case that you won. How do you like that?
You know, I haven't got it yet, to tell you the truth, Bob. The results just came out, but I got to tell you, that was it was a very difficult little course of fire they put on, and what it was the original. Now, this is before 9/11. The original Air Marshal qualification course that they had.
Cool.
And I'll tell you something. It was tough to shoot because every stage, there were 7 stages of fire, and you had to post under the minimum times and have accuracy before you could qualify. You had to do all 7 of them in the minimum time and with minimum accuracy. And it was tough. It was fast, and it was tough.
Cool.
So I'm trying to work it as well.
Our internet connection broke up there a little bit. Why don't you repeat that last sentence?
Okay. The course of fire was 7 stages. You had to shoot a minimum accuracy, and you have to shoot all 7 of them to qualify like that. And I'm actually going to try to work something like that in when I do a Wounded Warrior Tactical Conference here in Northwest Arkansas, because it's one of the toughest things I've ever shot.
Wow, yeah, okay. How does it differ from, like, a typical IDPA match?
Well, here's what I would say the difference was. Everything was done on 3 targets right in front of you, and the same position distance was the same on each one, but the par times were like draw and fire one shot, and I think the par time on it was like 1.2 seconds.
Wow.
Yeah, 1.2 seconds, and it was from concealment, too, by the way.
And so then they compared you against par.
Yeah, you had to make it under the par time and score an accurate hit to be able to qualify on that segment. And you had to do it twice, and your average of both times had to be underneath the par time.
How much below 1.2 were you?
You know what? I think barely. It was tough, Bob.
Pretty damn good. 1.2 seconds. Wow. That's pretty good.
From the holster, from concealment.
That's very – I can't do that. I'll admit it right away. I can't do that.
Well, I tell you that's what. Good. I looked at the time they were doing, and I went down, and I said, you know, I think I'm going to go do something that involves some shooting first so I can kind of get limbered up because – man, I mean, it was zippy. There is no two ways about that. And when I looked at that, I was just like, oh, my gosh. You know, this right here is going to be tough, guys.
So, yeah.
So I went after it with great alacrity and still felt like I had all I could do to make it.
Yeah, well, congratulations. You won the thing. That's great.
Well, you know, I did, and I had some stiff competition, and I got to say, you know, I felt like it was now, I want to say this. The person who really deserves probably the most G-Wow factor of it was Terry Strayer. And the reason I say that is Terry just about beat everybody on that thing. And
really?
Yeah, she was up there, and I think, you know, she was nipping at my heels. Matter of fact, Bob, I think I gave you a little bit of bad information. Let me read you this course of fire real quick, and if it causes anyone to go to sleep, I apologize. But here's stage one.
Make it quick. We got about 3 or 4 minutes.
Draw and fire one round from concealment, 1.65 seconds. Double tap, 1.35 seconds at stage two. Six rounds, one target, 3 seconds. One shot, speed reload, one shot, 3.25 seconds. One round on each of two targets, 3 yards apart, 1.65 seconds. 180-degree pivot draw, one round on each of three targets, 3.5 seconds. And one round, slide lock back, drop to one knee, reload, and fire one round, 4 seconds.
Wow, that's tough.
Yeah. So
that's tough.
They were kind of tough. Yeah. So anyway, I you know, felt like this was, I was like, where's this thing been, man? I mean, this was really rung everybody out. So I like courses that do that, Bob.
That's tough, boy. That's some hard. Those are some tough drills there. I'd like to be able to get a chance to shoot something like that at some point. That's kind of cool.
Well, you know, Bob, when I have my tactical conference up here, we're going to shoot this, and I'm inviting you right now to come up to it.
You let me know when it's going to be, and I'll get there. It's going to be somewhere in Arkansas, right?
Correct, Northwest Arkansas.
Oh, hey, that's a good excuse for me to go to Northwest Arkansas. I like going there.
Okay.
I'll be there. Make sure you tell me, give me a month or two advance notice.
You know what, Bob? I'll tell you what I'll do. I will actually, as soon as I know when this is at, if you'll have me back, I'll actually come out and announce it and give the details on your show, and we'll launch it from your show. How about that?
You got a deal.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.
You got a deal. That's good. And that's a good good stopping point. John, this has been fantastic. You gave out some good information. You know, you taught me some things, and I can't say that I agree with 100%, but I agree with about 95% of it, and that's okay because, you know, we're all we all learn from things like this, and that's great.
Bob, listen, I enjoy doing your stuff. It's always, you're always a hoot to talk to. And the thing I was going to tell you was I used to not agree with 100% of what I just said, but
really?
Really?
Okay.
I mean, there's things that I change my views on because, you know, I am purely pragmatic. If I need to abandon something because something else works better, I am freely will tell you, I used to be in the camp of this, this, and this, but I got away from it because of this, this, and this. And, you know, if I got a bias on something, I try to expose it. But, Bob, I'm pragmatic, man. If something's working for you, don't stop because I said it, you know?
Well, that's good. That's good. And thanks for coming on, folks. This was John Hideaway. He's the Wounded Warrior champion. Shooting champion. So congratulations again.
Thanks, Bob.
All right. Have a good evening.
Thanks, man. Bye.
Take care.
United States Concealed Carry Association is the most comprehensive, up-to-date resource for the law-abiding armed citizen. When you join USCCA, you'll make new friends with like-minded folks on private forums. Save time and money with our concealed carry gun and gear reviews. Enjoy your own subscription to Concealed Carry Magazine. Learn the latest in training and self-defense techniques. Enjoy peace of mind knowing you're properly prepared. Go to www.gunrightsradio.com/USCCA and sign up today. Gun Rights Radio Network is a proud affiliate of United States Concealed Carry Association.
All right. Many thanks again to John for coming on the show. Folks, you know, there's not much I can add to that. I think it was a great discussion. I hope you learned a lot from it. I certainly did. So I just want to close by asking you to make an investment, if you don't mind, help support the show and keep this going, into my Shooters Club premium podcast. And it's only $15. It'll be a private download. Only people who invest in the show will get some extra material that I don't cover on this public podcast that's always going to be free, by the way. It's a little extra something for people who support the show. Go to handgunworld.com, click the Shooters Club podcast up at the top of the page, or click the Buy Now button, and you'll see excellent instructions on how to download your copy of the Shooters Club premium podcast. And before I let you go, I also want to give you my email address if you'd like to comment about this show, bob@handgunworld.com. And, of course, there's the comments section below each show posting and the Gun Rights Radio Network Forum. That's it, folks. Thanks for tuning in again to episode 115 of the Handgun World Show. I'm Bob Main, and the reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Safe shooting, everybody. Talk to you next time. Goodbye.